From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Democratic Party has been enjoying minority status in Congress for some years now, but the midterm elections could change that. Unfortunately, rather than taking the temperature of how ordinary Americans are feeling and what they're thinking in the era of Donald Trump and Republican domination, Democrats are relying more on redistricting victories, voter registration, and anti-GOP fear-mongering. What they miss is how angry Americans are at both parties and how there is a resurgence of questioning among young people in particular about capitalism, the two-party system, and more. Now, a new anthology aims to challenge the status quo with a collection of essays by socialist writers. It's called U.S. Politics in an Age of Uncertainty, Essays on a New Reality. And its editor, Lance Selfa, is my guest. He is on the editorial board of the International Socialist Review. He's written the book, The Democrats, A Critical History. Welcome to the program, Lance.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So post-election, there was a lot of focus in the media between the differences regarding the Trump campaign versus the Clinton campaign, where Clinton failed. But it seems as though the real question should have been the two main sources of popular support and populism was the Trump campaign versus the Sanders campaign. Why is that the more sort of important battle, political battle to examine?
Well, there's a long history there, I think. And what the book tries to do is it tries to situate the 2016 election in a number of the political and social trends that did find their expression in 2016, with Trump on the one hand and Sanders on the other. What I think that all the contributors, at various degrees of emphasis here and there, they're all socialists. They have a certain perspective in terms of 40-year onslaught of free market, free trade policies that had devastated whole sections of U.S. Workers that had not seen a real rise in income in wages since the 70s, that expressed in certain kinds of social crises, from opioid crisis to mass incarceration and so on, a number of different issues that really create this kind of political polarization and this sense of discontent that was not really given any voice in the mainstream candidates. It was funny to remember that early 2016, it was thought that it was going to be a rematch between Bush and Clinton, because it was just thought that the mainstream Republican and Democratic parties were going to put their people in place. Well, the Democrats did succeed in doing that with Clinton, but after they basically had to hold off what should have been the kind of a canary in the coal mine for them of Sanders' popularity among whole sections of younger people, people of color, who voted for a person who called himself a socialist, 13 million or so people voted. So there was definitely an aspect there in the Clinton sort of side of things that large numbers of people that had been thought of as sort of the Democratic base really just didn't want to see another Clinton, and that Clinton herself represented probably all the things that are really terrible about the political establishment that has presided over this decline in conditions. Mm-hmm. On the other side, Trump was able to tap into at least a certain segment of Republican voters to be able to do that and kind of vanquish all the mainstream and non-mainstream Republicans, and then, rise out of that to be able to put a challenge to Clinton.
Now, there were millions of people that voted and millions of people that didn't vote. How important is it for us to understand why millions of Americans in a country that prides itself on its democratic tradition just didn't vote?
Yes. Well, I mean, it's one thing that's actually a real hallmark of the United States in relationship to all of the other major countries in Europe and Canada and so on that are often compared to the United States as being advanced capitalist countries with democratic elections and so on, that the United States usually lags behind all of them in terms of voter participation and voter and leads in terms of voter abstention. Now, there's a lot of different reasons for that, that have a lot of historical reasons, from probably the most obvious thing. For years, the disenfranchisement first of women, and then for African Americans for years and years. But in terms of the 2016 election, I think that the figures are such that probably when you add it up, you can see that the amount of votes that Clinton and Trump both got are about a little under 50% of the total potential voters in the population. Take another few 3, 4, 5 million people, I think it was 7 million, that voted for the third party candidates. What you're left with is a huge swath of people that just didn't vote. And that group trumps any of the other ones, the third parties, the Democrats or the Republicans.
You just don't hear lawmakers, politicians, people running for office thinking about, openly questioning why that is. Obviously, these are not all people who were purposely disenfranchised, i.e. people who wanted to vote but were prevented from. Most of them are probably people who simply chose to sit it out or for various reasons, chose to not vote.
Right. In fact, there's been some post-election polls looking, for example, at Wisconsin that showed that, in fact, I think the Census Bureau does this, where they ask people reasons why they don't vote. There was a small number that said because, that you could sort of put off to the voter suppression, it was too hard to get identification and so on. But much wider, 5, 6, 7 times that, saying, the candidates didn't speak to me, there was nothing worth voting for, et cetera. And I think that's one of the secrets as to why Trump was able to win. It wasn't so much that, and I think a lot of the contributions in this collection go through those figures and show there wasn't so much that there was some uprising of the populist, white working class throughout the Rust Belt that put Trump in the White House. It was actually a collapse for the most part of the Democratic voting base, or the defection of some amount of it to the third party candidates. And actually the Republican vote, except in, some certain specific places, didn't really go up that much. In fact, it wasn't, Mike Davis makes the point in one of his articles, or the article in the collection, that actually when you compare the amount of votes that Trump got versus the amount of votes that Romney got in losing pretty decisively to Obama the 4 years before, they weren't that much different.
So you have this whole section of the electorate that is simply disillusioned, disaffected. And this is also critical for us to discuss this population when we think about class politics. And of course, some people have blamed the Democrats for focusing on identity politics instead of focusing on class politics as Trump did, but that makes the assumption that people of color are not working class people and that it's just the white working class that matters. How important is it for us to just sort of drop this idea that identity politics are separate from class politics?
Oh, no, I think that as socialists, the writers in this journal or in this collection are very much want to challenge that view. And I think that Kanga Yamada Taylor's contribution, for example, that talks about black politics in the Obama and then into Trump era, definitely has a whole analysis about the racism that was manifested that provoked the Black Lives Matter movement and so forth under Obama. But she's also very clear to talk about how the social crisis that Black and Latino people feel is also felt in large swaths of white working class population. And so that the overall onslaught, I talked about that 40-year kind of campaign against working class living standards, actually shows how it's possible to bring these groups together to fight on a more common program. And I think some of the later articles, for example, the interview with Deepa Kumar about immigration politics, and it was mostly written earlier, but I think she added a couple things after the airport demonstrations right at the beginning of the Trump administration.
Against
the Muslim ban, yeah, that were a lot of people who were not Muslim or didn't necessarily have family members who were Muslim, but flocked to the airports to actually show that solidarity. That was really evident in that first week or two after Trump's inauguration. And I think it's been shown in many different sort of outbursts or protests since, from the women's marches to the The marches for science, you know, and a lot of other things that have happened since Trump's election.
As far as you can tell, Lance, the people who've marched, the people who are getting politically active, you know, it's how much of their energy is going to be lost or poured into electing Democrats in the midterm elections? And is it necessarily a bad thing if the Democrats that they're putting their weight behind are progressive Democrats?
Well, I guess I guess there's a couple things to say. First, I think probably it is the case that large numbers of people mobilized through these different mobilizations that we're talking about are going to go to the polls in 2018 because they don't really necessarily see that there's much alternative to and that you know, it's kind of the standard thing in American politics that the way you express discontent with the existing government is that you vote for the other people. But I think that's probably going to happen in a large way. And there's a lot of indications that the Republicans could lose the House because of that. But it doesn't mean that that people who are going to be involved in doing that aren't also going to be open to really drawing some conclusions that we hope this book actually helps them to do about what's really needed to build social movements, to build social power, to look beyond just the kind of quadrennial or every 2 year election cycle. And in terms of the question of who is promoted and, you know, which Democrats are promoted, I think that's an open question in terms of what the Democratic Party is planning, because I think there's kind of a battle inside the Democratic Party as to whether the people to win with are progressives or people would identify with people like Bernie Sanders, or whether you know, you have to just reach the people that voted for Trump before and therefore put the most conservative candidates that you can come up with.
And unfortunately, it seems as though the establishment Democratic Party is taking exactly the wrong lesson from indications that we're seeing about the internal strife within the party or internal dynamics. People who are pushing a Sanders-like agenda of being critical of capitalism, of being critical of Wall Street, are being pushed out.
Correct. Yeah. And so I think that, you know, there are opportunities or openings that will have to be developed in the future. And I think that one of the things that we try, again, that I think the book is trying to lay out is the degree to the culpability of the Democrats in actually laying the groundwork for Trump. The election was very close. It probably only swung on 70,000 votes. We all know that Clinton actually won almost 3 million more votes than Trump. So, you know, if you want to talk about attacks on democracy, we should talk about the Electoral College before we talk about Russian bots. But the question of what the Democratic Party sort of put in motion, and there's one of the essays on from Justin Akers, or it's an interview from Justin Akers Chacon, who basically goes through in great detail the kind of deportation machine that was built up under Obama that now Trump is using to carry out his hardline immigration or anti-immigration policies.
And how much of our nostalgia for not just George W. Bush, which is shocking in and of itself, but Barack Obama can be dangerous in this age? Certainly, of course, if any one of us had to today choose between Obama in office and Trump in office, we would choose Obama. But the whitewashing of the legacies of past presidents, because Trump is just so destructive, doesn't that pave the way for going back to a politics as usual rather than paving a new way forward that could actually strengthen the democratic institutions of the U.S.?
Right. Yeah, I mean, if you think about 2008, 2009, there was a lot of people writing articles about how Obama could be the new FDR and change the course of mainstream politics for the generation and so on. Within 2 years, the Democrats have been swept out of the House, and were pretty much the Republican agenda pretty much drove the next decade's politics after that. So it's not for lack of hope that it was a possibility of change that this didn't come into effect. So that's why I think it is important for us to actually write and document that as people would, you know, a lot of people would look back and say, oh, wasn't it much more much greater under Obama? And as you said, it's kind of amazing that people would even say the same thing about George W. Bush. But you know, some of the articles in the book are trying to say, well, no, things weren't so great under, I mean, the fact that Hillary Clinton ran on the most tone-deaf slogan of America is already great. Well, unfortunately for our millions of people did not feel great. And they showed what that meant to them by, you know, either not voting or voting third party, or some of them voting for Trump. So I think that idea too, that the Democrats are talking about norms and normalcy and getting back to normalcy, I think, as Kianga writes, you know, there's an intolerable status quo, and going back to the status quo or restoring the status quo is not something that's actually going to appeal to people. At the very best, probably it restarts the cycle all over again, in which the possibility of another Trump-like figure, or somebody who's actually more competent, less clownish, who with the same kind of politics, anti-democratic politics, could actually end up, you know, much more strong position in the future.
Hmm. So, Lance, there is some indication that young people are angry, energized, and, you know, it's tempting to romanticize that the youth will save us, since us adults have kind of screwed things up. But one of the things that did come out in the news even before the election was that there are growing numbers of young people who are Googling the word socialism, who are identifying as socialist, who are so, you know, in their own lives, seeing the devastation that neoliberal capitalism has wrought on them, that are willing to try a word that has long been considered political anathema in this country because of our history of the Red Scare. How is that overblown? Are these sort of, is this optimism about youth and their dalliances with socialism overblown?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, the fact that the Democratic Socialists of America are now have claimed 30,000 members, and that's about something like a tenfold increase or something over their membership just from a couple of years ago, is really an indicator of that there is something to this idea that large numbers of young people, and actually, the, far as I know, the majority of the people that have joined to bring up the membership figures of DSA are a large numbers of the millennials, people in their 30s, whatever. I mean, they see, and I mean, that's also probably one of the underpinnings of Sanders' appeal as well, that their almost whole existence has been in a time growing up with the domination of these sort of neoliberal policies where, you know, school, student debt, things, you know, cost too much money. They might have gone through, you know, had families that lost houses in the financial collapse of 10 years ago. So that's kind of the underpinning, I think, of the interest in some kind of different kind of society, some kind of way of changing things. The fact also is that this generation of young people is the most multiracial of all, or in you know, many generations. So I think that those two things kind of going together gives the sense that, one, they're looking for some kind of an alternative, or at least large numbers are, and there's a real possibility to build something on the left that would actually capture that and actually try to actually make real social change. There hasn't really been a large scale social movement that had the impact of pushing society to the left on a large scale since, you know, the 1960s and the civil rights and black power movements in that era. So we could be on the cusp of something like that. On the other hand, and I will say, though I think it's probably a smaller development, there's also the aspect of the political polarization is the attraction among some layer of young people to the far right as well,
right?
Like the people that demonstrated in Charlottesville, Virginia, back in August. So the kind of who actually wins this generation is really going to have a major say as to what, how the future of American politics is going to be.
Therefore, the organizing by the left and organizing efforts by the left remain more critical than ever. Your book covers the political terrain in this past year of the Trump administration. But going from there to not just the midterm elections, but beyond, any thoughts on how people could take some of the critical analysis that your book lays out and apply it to, furthering progressive values?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one thing that's important is that the analysis that's laid out, one of the things that it shows is that what is sort of usually on offer from the mainstream liberal organizations that are tied up with the Democratic Party is inadequate. Yeah. And so that we have to
You're not excited about Oprah 2020?
No. No, and if I can just say an example, I mean, Planned Parenthood has received a lot of money and support as it's under attack from the right. And yet their political strategy is not about trying to mobilize people, to build large numbers of people who would actually come out and defend abortion clinics or defend the right to abortion. And so while they've maintained a kind of alliance with the Democratic Party for years, the abortion rights have been eroded to the point of being taken away in a number of places. So a new movement, a new feminist movement will be needed to kind of put those, to try to win back some of the things that have been lost over the years. And I think you can go through a number of different places across a number of different issues, a number of different venues about that, where you can see that possibility or that necessity as well. And then, I think we, at least people like me as socialists, we talk about trying to build a political alternative to a kind of two-party system that really just doesn't present larger and larger numbers of people with anything that is attractive to them. I mean, the best that is often on offer by the Democrats is usually, I hold my nose and vote for the lesser evil, because at least they're not as bad as the other guys. In fact, the Democrats tried to run on that slogan. They were talking about using that slogan in the midterm
elections. The
lesser
of two evils as a slogan?
No, they're not as, have you seen the other guys? In other words, we got nothing to offer, but the other ones are even worse. I mean,
wow.
That's hardly, hardly a recipe for inspiration.
I mean, it might as well be lesser of two evils. It's essentially what that's.
That's right. Yeah, right. At least,
oh, my goodness.
So that's the something I think this younger generation of people that are becoming political under the Trump era are going to have to grapple with and think about and what that means. I mean, I'm not saying it's going to be an easy road. The political system is pretty well structured to prevent the kind of changes that would be necessary, but it has happened in the past. It can happen in the future.
Well, Lance, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thanks a lot.
Lance Selfa is the author of The Democrats, A Critical History. He's also on the editorial board of the International Socialist Review. We've been discussing the new book that he's just edited from Haymarket Books. It's called U.S. Politics in an Age of Uncertainty, Essays on a New Reality. And we're going to post information about that book on our website later today. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.